In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. The Bank of England and the Federal Reserve Bank in the United States have stimulated the economy by pumping money into it, a process known as quantitative easing. The central bank purchases assets such as government and corporate bonds. This money is created out of thin air, a sum paid for the use of money, known also as a theft of time. Debt among 19 to 29-year-old people living in the United States now exceeds $1 trillion. That's according to the New York Federal Reserve Consumer Credit Panel. Another large portion of consumer debt in the United States is the home mortgage. It's not well known that at the end of a 30-year mortgage with compound interest and taxes added, the homeowner essentially pays for the home three times. Lending money at interest is called usury. That's when more is demanded back than what is given. For the first 1,500 years of Christianity, usury was condemned by the early church as a contravention to divine law. Profiting from interests on a loan was a transgression against God, and in some cases equivalent to murder. Returning guest author and scholar Michael Hoffman has deeply researched the suppressed biblical and medieval Catholic doctrine about interest on money, also known as the canker coin. Hoffman says, Western civilization has been profoundly disfigured by the exculpation of the charging of interest on debt. Generations have come and gone without knowing their lives were misshapen by a system of usury. We travel back in time and into the depths of hell with author Michael Hoffman as we learn how the lending of money at interest crept into the church. It was an incremental process of sophistry and doublespeak that is documented in Michael's book titled Usury in Christendom, The Mortal Sin That Was and Now Is Not. Michael, welcome back to Another News.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Jeff.
This book is a pioneering study you've compiled, and I didn't know anything about how usury slowly crept its way into the church and that it was regarded as such a heavy transgression against God. It's normalized now in our society. What led you to research about usury from this perspective?
Well, Dante Alighieri in the Inferno, Canto 11, is where he talks about taking any return on the principle of money, which is called usury, as being unnatural and as being synonymous with many other grievous sins. Now, if it was a Catholic preacher who had made those statements from the medieval era, we could dismiss them. But Dante is such a giant in Western letters that he's not easily dismissed. And so I could say that, like Dante, who talked about art as being the motivator for his own view of economics and indeed the world itself, I was motivated by Dante's art to look deeper into this because I have been concerned with root causes rather than symptoms. And there have been all kinds of economic nostrums and remedies that have put forward and indeed are being put forward to this day, which are only Band-Aid approaches to the fundamental cause of why we are ruled by the money power today. We're 20 months away from a presidential election. There's a great deal of opinion being put forth, and I find most of it just futile, absolutely futile, because as long as compound interest is in effect, a fundamentally unnatural process, we can't compete against compound interest. And therefore, the people who are not inventors, they are not farmers, they are not creators, they're not factory owners. They're simply people who manipulate, and now digitally, numbers, and then derive immense wealth from that. How can we expect that the dominion of that type of personality is going to be productive of our society? It's going to be very destructive. We are ruled by the money power. Dante saw that in the Middle Ages, And so I turn to the campaign against any interest on money, which it's very important to note we're talking about any return on the principal rather than what people imagine that usury means, an unconscionable profit. So that, for example, loan sharking. But if you'll indulge me, my definition of usury, and it's from my other book, I've written two books that touch on this subject, one, Usury in Christendom, The Mortal Sin That Was and Now Is Not. And the other one is The Occult Renaissance Church of Rome. And I have a chapter on the breeders of money gain dominion over the Church of Rome. And so I'll quote from that. In submission to a scriptural standard, no Christian lender may gain a profit from a loan by charging fees that substitute for an interest rate. In all cases where a borrower repays a loan on time and in full, any charge of any kind beyond the return of the principal represents a profit to the lender and a loss to the borrower and constitutes usury. The loopholes are the extrinsic titles, which under this and other deceptive euphemisms in most cases lead to profit on a loan at the expense of the borrower. And so that's not to say, you know, people can be thinking, well, gee, I want to invest my money. If I can't do it at interest, how do I do it? Well, you become an investor. And instead of banks, we should have enterprises that are directing investments towards progressive companies and startups that are going to add value to the world. And naturally, if you buy into a company as a shareholder, you're entitled to a return because, first of all, you're taking a risk that you're going to lose your money. And secondly, you're investing in something that's tangible and real rather than simply the renting of money. And so both my books are concerned with theology and the history of theology as this plague of usury developed. And I think we have to make that clear in distinction from people like Michael Hudson, who you and I were discussing over email, who has written a secular book examining, and particularly where he's valuable is in examining how usury was viewed by the ancients in antiquity. So I thought it's important to make that distinction that I am discussing Christian theology here. That's the main center and focus of my work.
It's a very interesting perspective. One of the many key turning points allowing money lending with interest is mentioned in referencing the birthplace of Gentile or non-Judaic usury. It was in a response to Gregory of Rimini in 12th century Florence, quote, necessity makes it lawful. Would you please talk about some of the arguments for usury, such as, well, that was 1,000 years ago and the financial systems are much different now?
Right. And so that is the argument that the church never confronted modern capitalism and all of the vagaries of it. And it was a simpler time. And therefore, strict adherence to Jesus Christ in Luke chapter 6, in where he talks about lend expecting nothing in return, that can be overthrown now because the situation has changed. Well, from a Christian perspective, once you admit that situation ethic, then you have undermined the entire gospel itself, because anything that's inconvenient to you, if you decide to commit adultery and cheat on your wife, then you can say the times are different. This is a sexual revolution we're living in, and therefore adultery doesn't really apply. So it creates anarchy, and this is what's really happened, not only in the church, but in Christianity as a whole, where we see this right-wing conservatism, which actually isn't a conservatism. They're conserving very little. And they emphasize certain aspects of their opposition to social changes in society. I would say Jeff Sessions is the perfect example, Trump's former attorney general, who put himself forth as a moral, ethical person trying to return to biblical values. And yet the worst prison, or among the worst prison systems in America, is in his home state of Alabama, where it's an absolute disgrace. And where men are subject to rape and beatings, the attitude is, well, they're in prison. That's sort of an added penalty. Well, that's not biblical at all. In fact, in the Bible, there are no prisons except for battle captives and those awaiting imprisonment. So for Jeff Sessions to be consistent, he ought to adhere to the whole of the law as it applies after Christ came. And I'm finding that loopholes like this are very subversive of Christianity in general, because young people have their antenna up when it comes to hypocrisy. And I think that we're seeing a falling away from scriptural values and from what Jesus actually taught as a result of some of this hypocrisy that they're viewing. I myself am neither right-wing nor left-wing. I'm not anchored to the seating arrangement of the French National Assembly of 1789. And in fact, there's even a biblical verse that says, go neither to the left nor to the right. But I do want to point out inconsistencies here, and they begin with situation ethics. For example, in the case of Thomas Aquinas, you know, who, as you know, is an illustrious figure in Christianity, and it's his prestige, which is cited quite often as claiming that he was one of the first to institute various extrinsic titles such as lucrum sessions and damnum sessions. And so what I'd like to do here, if you would indulge me, is quote from historian Christopher A. Franks. He elaborates on the Christian economics of Aquinas. St. Thomas' position on usury depends not on a particular way of configuring money, but on the very notion of abstractable exchange value that any understanding of money presupposes. Thomas argues that abstracted exchange value as such cannot have a vendable use value in addition to the exchange value that it abstracts. When Thomas says one man cannot overbound in external riches without another man lacking them, we are tempted to read it as a mere pious assertion to shame the rich. But it is firmly rooted in Thomas's assumptions about how God provides for human beings through fruitfulness of nature. And parenthetically here, I would say that this is what Dante is talking about in Canto 11 of the Inferno as well. So continuing now with the quotation from Mr. Franks, to make a claim to wealth that outstrips that provision, the provision of God through the fruitfulness of nature, as usury does, is to produce injustice. Thomas's centerpiece argument attacks the very notion of usury, but he supports it with other arguments about a variety of possible titles to interest. In both cases, his arguments are meant to preserve but justice by rejecting inordinate claims to wealth. Thomas's centerpiece argument does not hinge on an antiquated understanding of money, and this is what you and I were just bringing up. Thomas sees in the very notion of an abstracted exchange value the possibility of economic activities that obscures the primacy of use values. What all of Thomas's positions on titles to income from money show is an insistence that profit can only come from nature's goods, which always requires the patience and vulnerability that waits to see what nature offers. Thomas refuses the presumption against God's providence that would seek to secure a claim to wealth that outpaces that provision. To contract a price for the use of money, in addition to the principle, is to sell a use that does not and cannot exist. Thomas's arguments, by uncovering the most basic reason against usury, that it sells a metaphysical impossibility, confirms the rationale of the usury prohibition even in productive loans where the borrower is not needy. Thomas is concerned not only for charity, but for keeping all exchanges answerable to the contours of what is real wealth. The consumptibility argument is not meant to destroy all possible arguments for a return on one's money. The lender at interest presumes by staking a claim to wealth, possible future wealth, that is not disciplined by any receptivity to what God's providence may actually end up providing. So that's what we regard as wrong. But what is correct is the investor. In the investment model, the investor does not presume but takes the risk of waiting to see what comes of his investment. He does not hold the title to the return of all his money, but rather makes himself vulnerable to the contingencies of how God's provision may or may not smile on the efforts of the merchant or the craftsman to whom the money is entrusted. So, end quote from Christopher Franks. And then I go on in my book, The Occult Renaissance, in the chapter on breeders of money, to talk about lucrum sessions and damnum emergence, which are two of the loopholes which have been constructed by theologians of the post-Renaissance Church of Rome to justify what we have today, which is, of course, there's no usurer is forbidden communion or participation in the Catholic Church, despite a lot of double talk and rhetoric to the contrary.
Usury is said to have disfigured Western society, and you've preempted this question in your answer in reading the passage, of course. But what do you imagine our society to be without a system of currency that charges interest on loans that would adhere to the natural law of God?
I think that you would see what we saw in the Middle Ages, as much as they are condemned now in what is, a general and rather reckless condemnation of every aspect of Western civilization. Fundamentally, it's a lack of gratitude, because we continue to benefit from the better parts of it today, recognizing that there were also many failings. But when you look at, for example, Saxon England before the invasion by the Normans, and you look at, for example, if you've walked around England and you've looked at Saxon architecture compared with Norman architecture, and, you know, the built-up world is one of the prime indicators of a society's ethics and character. And in the Saxon world, the architecture is a human scale. It's in proportion. And the Norman architecture, although compared today, you know, these things are they're a matter of a degree. But the Norman architecture is, you're beginning to see the contours of a kind of gigantism. You had the peasantry, even though you had classes of unfree peasants known as villeins, from which we get the pejorative of villain, but initially that was a technical term for unfree labor in the Middle Ages. But nonetheless, I believe that society was not ruled by the money power. It was ruled by people who, however imperfectly, believed in Christ. Now, we can bring all kinds of things into this, the Crusades and this villainage that I talk about and so forth. But I think that in modern society, we certainly are capable of visualizing a world where we are not ruled by the money power. And what that would mean is that the people who own the media of mass communication, the people who were in charge of our society, might be farmers. Virtue is not necessarily inherent in the occupation of farming or building, although Thomas Jefferson thought that in terms of agriculture it was. But I think that there's a greater likelihood that people who are heavily invested in building things, and essentially what Dante might have said, or Ezra Pound for that matter, heavily invested in life, because let's get down to brass tacks here. We were talking about situation ethics as being a fundamental problem. And another one is the struggle between life and death. And I think you're familiar with some of my work in secret societies and psychological warfare, talking about the Western occult and how heavily it was invested in certain types of conspiratorial, anti-life, anti-human prophecies, and one of those was John Dee, astrologer royal to Queen Elizabeth I in the 16th century, who predicted that in the future there would be the reign, R-E-I-G-N, the reign of dead matter. And so that's what we're beginning to see as the digital world, artificial intelligence takes us over more and more. This is dead matter. And so for me, a fundamental dichotomy here is between life and death. And it seems to me that people who derive their sustenance from the renting of money would be more on the death side than on the life side. And I think that was very obvious centuries ago. And I think it would, I think in the era of Bernie Sanders and others who, however imperfectly, are trying to build a better society, I think that it would be patent to them. And who knows, if someone in the forthcoming election were to propose the abolition of the renting of money, I think that might actually catch on, because it's so fundamental and basic that I think the vision is fairly clear for it, although it would be a massive struggle, because you're really taking away the whole basis of how we are ruled.
Michael, the Christian Directory that you cite from 1838 reads, "Usury was an act of murderous hostility, warfare by other means, licensed against the peoples who the Israelites were attempting to destroy, but unthinkable among people who had to live amicably together." Well, the Fourth Lateran Council addressed usury and how it affected Christians negatively by Judaic money lenders. The original manifest usurers of Europe were the Jews, who were not subject to jurisdiction of the church. I realize this is a sensitive topic, but it's important to understand in terms of the church having jurisdiction over the Christians. Can you talk more about Canon 67 of the Fourth Lateran Council?
Okay, Canon 67 of the Fourth Lateran Council. So the Fourth Lateran Council is a medieval council. What you have there is it addresses usury only as it negatively affected Christians oppressed by usurious Judaic moneylenders. So no one under the jurisdiction of the church was allowed to receive interest on loans, but Judaic people were not under the jurisdiction of the church. And that's what made them the original manifest usurers of Europe in that sense. They were not subject to the jurisdiction of the papacy. Then an anti-Judaic statement would be added to that. They were also not subject to qualms of conscience. I think that that's unfair. The actual Canon 67 reads, the more Christians are restrained from the practice of usury, the more they are oppressed in this matter by the treachery of the Jews, so that in a short time they exhaust the resources of the Christians. Wishing, therefore, in this matter to protect the Christians against cruel oppression by the Jews, we ordain in this decree that if in the future, under any pretext, Jews extort from Christians oppressive and immoderate interest, the partnership of the Christians shall be denied them till they have made suitable satisfaction for their excesses. The Christians also, every appeal being set aside, shall, if necessary, be compelled by ecclesiastical censure to abstain from all commercial intercourse with them. It's very problematic because what it's doing is, while it's trying to protect Christians from Judaic usury, it's not taking into account something that's unspoken here, and that is that Old Testament Israel, with which the Church of Christ identified as its precursor, of course, Old Testament Israel was given the right to use usury as a weapon of warfare against the stranger or the alien. Now, people will say, oh, well, that's typical Judaic vengeance. Every poor stranger or alien that comes along, they're going to use usury against them. Not at all. If you're going into the original Hebrew, then you have to make a distinction between nakri and ger. And unfortunately, in the King James Bible and subsequent translations, they don't do that. The ger were aliens and strangers who were not hostile to Israel, and they were allowed to reside inside Israel, and they were allowed to participate in the life of society and to gain a living as long as it was not a form of exploitation or oppression of the Israelites. The Nakri, however, were another stranger or alien who were hostile to Israel and sought their demise. They were the only ones that the God of Israel had said, you can use usury as a weapon of warfare against them. I think there's two instructive things here. One is that the Old Testament, of course, is recognizing that usury is a very powerful, destructive weapon. So that's important to note. Secondly, that Israel was granted the right to use it against a hostile alien. So if we come now to Christian society, many Judaics saw the Christians who had dominion over them as being cruel and oppressive, and it would be natural to their theology to engage in usury. So the church had to make a determination. Either Judaic people would not be allowed in the territory, or if they were, there had to be an acknowledgement that this usury was going to be applied according to Old Testament regulations themselves. And another problem is the hypocrisy of this, because in so many cases, Christian rulers would turn around, especially during the Renaissance, less so in medieval times, but certainly there were breaches of it, and accept usury loans from the Judaic usurers. Now, it's not a sin under Catholic law to take a loan at interest, because it's understood that that's something that if people have no other way to get a loan, they're not committing the sin. The sin is on the part of the person who is extending the loan at usury. However, I want to make it clear, we understand that there are also cheaters among debtors, and so that debtors can refuse to pay a loan, and therefore there were extra fees that could be tacked on. That's one way that Thomas Aquinas has been indicted here, as supposedly on the side of the change agents within the church who have accepted capitalism. All he ever said is that if a debtor is trying to defraud a lender and violates the terms of the loan by not paying it back on time, it's common justice that there would be a fine for that. He never said that there should be any charge on the principal itself. So that distinction has to be made. And so anyhow, it's a very complex issue. I don't want to make it a black hats, white hats dichotomy. I think there was truth and justice on both sides. But one of my main goals here in writing, as I do on usury, is to make clear to people, especially in the right-wing and conservative circles, and perhaps not so much in liberal ones, although the old-time leftists of the early 20th century would have been familiar with this. Pound and Ezra Pound and his circle more or less started focusing attention on predatory usury with the rise of the Protestant banks in Amsterdam, which Pound especially in London, because he was really infuriated by the Bank of London, and insinuating that this was a Judaic cabal, that all Protestants were much more sympathetic to Judaism than Catholicism was. That's not true in the Renaissance era. So Pound creates this idea that, you know, the Rothschilds and the Bank of England, that's where he starts his history of destructive usury. And what's kind of perverse about Pound, and I do admire him for his courage and the assistance he gave to T.S. Eliot, and very altruistically as well. There's a lot to salute in Pound, and there's been a lot of misunderstanding about him. But he avoids the Medici. He avoids where you see the real starting point. You asked about the Gentiles and Judaics, but we're overlooking the enormous impact of Gentile usury as it was beginning to be allowed in the Catholic Church in the 15th century, and then codified by the first Medici Pope to gain the throne of Peter in Rome, and that was Leo X, who was the nemesis of Martin Luther. And much of Luther's complaints about the papacy, now obscured today, were economic and centered on usury as well. And here we had the anniversary, 500th anniversary of Luther's 95 Theses, and this was hardly even brought up. It's kind of maddening when you think of the human imbecility here sometimes in trying to get the truth out. But so my point is that what's, for me, what's most necessary, what's most radical and revisionist about this era is to understand that modern banking as we know it, modern predatory capitalism as we know it, did not begin with these sort of comparative penny-ante kind of Judaic pawnbrokers. It actually began with the great Italian Catholic and German Catholic banking dynasties, such as the Fuggers in Germany, Strozzi, the Medici, the Oliveri, and many, many others in Rome itself. And as they gained this banking power under Leo X, the first Medici Pope, then they were able to move in and buy church offices because, you know, money talks. And so they were able to place cardinals and even popes into power based on simony, in other words, the purchase of these ecclesiastical offices. And that's why I see, even though most historians would say that the Renaissance was the glory of the Catholic Church because of the magnificent artworks, I think if you look beneath that, and many have failed to do so, you'll actually see the beginnings of the end of any semblance of Christianity inside the church. You know, a fish rots from the head down, so much of this rot did not reach the people in the pews and the parish priests, all of whom thought the church was opposed to usury. And it wasn't until much later that these things could be revealed to the common people. So these conspiracies were afoot at the top, and the Vatican has been masters of double talk and distracting rhetoric. And so they were able to maintain a facade of being opposed to usury. At the same time, they were the main engine for getting it started. And then much later, the Protestants in Amsterdam and in London followed suit. But for Pound to begin his history of predatory usury with the Protestants instead of what happened in the Church of Rome, I think has been a real problem in right-wing and conservative circles, and it's one that I've tried to expose.
Yes, I believe it's a trap for people to begin to talk about Jews being primarily the merchants of usury. And it's used as an alibi, as you point out, and a scapegoat, when the history of Gentile usury is really the main engine.
Right, absolutely. And also, I mean, I'm not taking away from the kind of predatory capitalism that the Rothschild Bank did represent. There's no question about that. In fact, when you finally see under Pius VII in Italy, we're talking now in 1830, because the process of this usury gaining firm purchase inside the Church of Rome was gradual. And many of these revolutionary changes inside the church did have to be incremental. Otherwise, the common people, the peasantry, the parish priests would have revolted. So they had to dial down their process. And it reached its apex in 1830 under Pius VII, where he decided and decreed that no one needed to confess the sin of renting money any longer. No one could be refused communion. And up until that time, many were being admitted to the church in spite of their usury, but it was something that was a local issue. Here the Pope had made it through what's called the penitentiary, which is what rules over the discipline of confessors. In other words, the theology that guides confessors in the confessional. So, okay, just shortly after that ruling, the Rothschilds made a sizable loan to the Pope and the Vatican. And that's all documented. That's not conspiracy theory. So is that a coincidence? I leave it to your listeners to decide, or historians and researchers to dig out. But so I'm not minimizing the impact of the Rothschilds, I think, over the British crown, the role of the Rothschilds in colonialism, imperialism, and various wars, including anti-Christian wars, for example, getting the British to support the Turks against the Greek Christians, which is a known aspect of Rothschild history. But we have to be fair, and we have to understand that this image of the grasping, miserly Judaic is not only abhorrent, but it's actually wrong. First of all, if anybody knows anything about Orthodox Judaism, the highest objective of an Orthodox Judaic father is not to marry his daughter to a billionaire, but to marry his daughter to a Talmid Chacham, in other words, to a Talmud scholar, a brilliant Talmud scholar, the Gedolim of the generation. So right there, it goes to show that within their own circle, they're not ruled by money, And I think the problem is that you have had this conspiracy of Gentile bankers who have distracted from their own avarice and their own control of the Church of Rome in the Renaissance and post-Renaissance period by casting aspersions and making and creating the scapegoat out of the Judaic usurer. And even when you look at Oliver Twist by Charles Dickens, which is supposed to be this paramount anti-Semitic text because of how it presents Fagin, and actually, Fagin was really based on a true life character, Ikey Solomons, who was a early Victorian dealer in stolen goods. So Dickens there was just reporting what the reality was. But if you look closely at the text of Oliver Twist, he has a much more dangerous foe in that book, and that's monks. Monks was Oliver's half-brother, and he was betraying Oliver as a result of his own greed. And really, the message of Oliver Twist, with a deep reading of it, is that it's betrayal by our own people that is the cause of so much of our trouble. And I think that if you take that and telescope it to the Renaissance era, that's exactly where the focus should be. The trouble has been inside Christendom with these usurious bankers.
And in your research, you've cited a range of penalties for usury, such as those considered manifest by the Lateral Council of 1179. And would you please go over some of the penalties, such as not being buried in a proper cemetery? And why do you think it's important to know about this historic documentation?
One of the things I've tried to do is dig out some of these anemic figures of piety that exist in the church today when it looks at its past. One of these is a great saint of the church named Anthony of Padua. And nowadays he's known as the patron saint of lost things, and he's pictured as having been given the privilege of holding the baby Jesus in some type of vision. Well, that's all well and good, but the fact of the matter is that Anthony of Padua, like Francis of Assisi and many of the other very worthy saints of the early church and Middle Ages, was a determined foe of usury, of the renting of money, and this is obscured. He gave numerous sermons which attracted thousands of people to come and listen to him. This was an absolute red line with him, and it's in my book, The Occult Renaissance. I quote from some of the sermons, but I mention it because there was a miracle of St. Anthony, and this illustrates his animus towards this weaponized avarice, which is what usury is. in that it was the funeral of a usurer, which they weren't really actually supposed to be allowed to have a funeral, as you're intimating. But in this case, for some reason, it was there, and St. Francis said his heart was so corrupt that it's not in his body, it's in his gold safe. And the people went running out, and they actually ripped his body open. There was no heart in it, according to this miracle story. And when they went to his gold safe, there was his heart. Now, whether that's true or not, of course, is up to, you know, whoever wants to accept such things. But you can see the allegory behind it. From there comes a rather grisly practice among the people. If a usurer died, at the very least, a Catholic usurer died, at the very least in his will, he had to make restitution. And that means that he had to return his ill-gotten gains. If it was seen that he had not made provision for that, or he could not, maybe he had fallen on hard times, typically his body would be vandalized, the casket would be destroyed, his remains would be thrown into a river. The people really execrated this. It was a horrible reputation was attached to being a usurer. And that's where it gets kind of interesting, because the theological nemesis of Martin Luther was Johann Eck. And Eck was actually a creature of the Fugger banking dynasty. He was like their house theologian. And he had been charged with the project of making usury reputable, because the Fuggers, who were among the wealthiest people in the Western world at that time, were still execrated by the common people. And they wanted that stigma and stain lift from them. And they paid Eck to do it. And he involved himself in various disputations. So I think it's interesting that the person who opposed Luther on the indulgence racket was actually involved in trying to burnish the reputation of the people involved in the usury racket. But now in Florence and in other areas where we talked about the magnificent artworks, you had some people, some usurers like the Scrovegni family, for example. They built a magnificent chapel as a way of making amends. I'm not sure how the common people felt about that, because they didn't get their money returned, their interest returned on the loans. Instead, a magnificent chapel was built. But there was a genuine guilt on the part of Catholics at that time to be involved in this. And the unfortunate thing was, is that when the shadow side, the shadow banking that existed in the shadows up until when the Vatican was beginning this incremental permission for usury through the Monte di Pieta, through a charity bank, as they called it. Prior to that, there was this stigma attached to it, and that itself acted as a hold, as an obstacle to any type of large institutional basis for usury. And then once the popes, especially Leo X, was notorious for this, for using Monte di Pieta, which means the Mountain of Compassion. It was a medieval institution for lending interest-free to the poor and the deserving. And then when the Medici got control over it, they said, well, we have to charge some interest on this for administrative purposes. Well, the bank in the Middle Ages, the administrative costs were donated by the various philanthropists who were involved. And by the time of Leo in the 16th century, I mean, this was a ruse in order to get the camel's nose under the tent, so to speak, and begin this incremental formal permission for usury. And that's how they did it. They said, we need better banks for lending to the poor. We have to put them on a professional basis, so there must be some basic interest charge. And then, as I point out, in both the occult Renaissance Church of Rome and usury, the mortal sin that was and now is not, very rapidly, that so-called charity bank was not at all for the benefit of the poor, other than in a very token and theatrical fashion, but was for the benefit, of course, of the Medici and the other gangsters who would then join in what was an ever-widening banking dynasty. 5% was the figure that they were going for at the time. That sounds very reasonable today, but it violates a principle. For example, if we're saying that prostitution is only harmful if the prostitute charges $10,000, but if she charges $5, then it's okay, then, you know, you really are not, your problem isn't with prostitution, but at the cost of it. So if our problem is with what renting money, how it corrodes the soul and society itself, it doesn't matter. Once you get it allowed at any percentage, then it's a huge problem because it's overturned a fundamental biblical law. And so this is what happened. And I would just like to inject here, Jeff, that Calvin, again, and the Protestants get the blame for initiating usury. Calvin wasn't even born when the nominalists, who prefigured Eck and the Fuggers, began pushing for a 5% interest rate, which Calvin himself would eventually permit, somewhat grudgingly, but he did permit later on. But this was all, the beginning of this was all in the bowels of the Renaissance Catholic Church.
When I was reading this, the charitable loans reminded me of the countrywide home loans in 2005 and 2006. I remember reading a blog called The Controversy Papers in 2005, and he transcribed a conversation he had with the mortgage lender about the bank preferring that he mortgage the home instead of paying for it outright. He told the banker that he didn't want to pay for his home three times. Well, you write that author of Introduction to Christian Economics, Gary North, charges that strict abstinence from all forms of usury will create homeless people, and you add that this is true only in a nation full of mutual strangers and enemies where no one would loan freely to his brother as God requires. Would you talk more about this, please?
Yes, because that's, again, returning to the Old Testament. A lot of people will say, well, I'm for the New Testament, but not the Old Testament. Well, that's an impossibility because Jesus and the disciples quoted the Old Testament hundreds of times approvingly. So if you're throwing out the Old Testament, it's just an indirect way of getting rid of Christ. But in the Old Testament, you have this economics. There is a godly economics in the Old Testament, and it was continued on into the New Testament. For example, all loans have to end after 7 years in the so-called sabbatical year. And so, because God never intended for his people to spend a lifetime in debt, as our people do today. And in the Christian era, this was extended to all people. It wasn't limited to the Israelites alone. One of the problems here is that Hillel, the famous first century alleged contemporary of Jesus, and a very important rabbi Pharisee at the time, issued a prose bull, P-R-O-Z-B-U-L, and there are other spellings of it, but that's the main one, which actually nullified the sabbatical year, and it allowed the lender to extend the loan beyond 7 years. And so here we see a loophole. We see the situation ethics, which has bedeviled the Catholic Church, was also bedeviling Judaic people from the first century onward. And I have a prose bull document in my files from the last sabbatical year, which was either 2014 or 2015, and it overturns not just the spirit of the law, but the law itself. So people can say, well, let's look for another source of economic fairness than the Old Testament. And I say to that, good luck, because there's still a tremendous prestige and credibility to the Old Testament. It's in Ezekiel 18 against usury. I think it's Psalm 15 that asks to define who is the righteous man. And if the English translation is faithful to the original Hebrew, it'll say, the righteous man is he who does not take interest on money. So these things are built in, and they are built in on the supposition that we will be a nation of neighbors. Now, I don't mean this in a utopian sense, but I mean it in the sense that a much more caring and compassionate society, which is preached from the housetops by all political parties and practiced by virtually none, but a more compassionate and caring society where we can say, I've investigated your character, you have a good work record, you seem like a fine woman or a fine man, I'm going to lend you this money, and it's interest-free. Now, one of the things, again, on the part of the debtor would be to have a loving and caring attitude of gratitude to that lender. So let's say as a result of that loan, the home was saved or the business was successful. In that case, as long as it isn't coerced or expected, that debtor can freely give a gift to the lender in thanks for doing that. And so you would have a society of mutuality. I know it probably sounds utopian to some people, but the thing that Christopher Franks was talking about, who I quoted extensively from earlier, and that I'm concerned with as well, is for those of us who are Christians, okay, and the Christian love that Jesus promulgated, that Christian love entails this. It doesn't mean that we're to be fools or necessarily to lend the people who are reckless and have all kinds of alcoholic or drug addicted problems. You know, I mean, there's also a kind of common sense to this, and it can be judicious. But this is the loving, caring, compassionate society. And I think that the Band-Aid approach to this, anything other than abolishing this compound interest with which no other force in the world can compete, the greatest invention, the Steve Jobs, the Microsoft, they can't make and they will not make as much money as the people who are in charge of the hedge funds and the compound interests do. So until we have an abolition, and let it be voluntary at first, and let people see that it works, and let it see that it's a reflection of Christ's love in each and one of our hearts, until we have that growing in society and at least becoming an issue in our elections, locally and nationally, I don't think we're going to advance very far. And I think that there's going to be people who are exploiting calls for economic justice, which, coming from, as I said earlier, I'm not right wing or left wing, I'm very dubious about enormous taxes on people, taking my labor, the fruit of my labor, and deciding that because I'm middle class, you're going to, you know, take my money and put it over here. Now, a certain level of taxation is necessary, and it's biblical as well. But I'm finding that out of desperation, and it's an understandable desperation to fight this money power, we're coming up with solutions that are rather suspicious to me, and that they generate more hostility and conflict in society, because a lot of people quite rightly say, I worked hard for that money and I want to keep it, which is one reason why they flee high tax states like New York and Illinois, especially where there are property taxes, where after having working hard and paid for your home residence that you inhabit, you now have to pay rent to the government in the form of a property tax. And these are other issues we could discuss another time with a biblical basis. But in general, what you're saying about that lack of love, that's the system that we have today. And when we really are practicing Christian ethics, then I believe we'll be able to have a mindset that can begin to approach the contours of usury abolition.
Indeed, yeah, really strong points, Michael. And I'm sure there are listeners out there that remember that those moments when somebody had faith in them and believed in them and trusted them, those are usually powerful turning points in a person's life. Michael, you quote Wendell Berry, author of The Art of the Commonplace, The Agrarian Essays, and he's quoted, "We will discover that our destruction of nature is not just bad stewardship or stupid economics or betrayal of family responsibility. It's a horrid blasphemy. It's flinging God's gifts into his face as if they were of no worth beyond that assigned to them by our destruction of them. We have the right to use what we need, but no more, which is why the Bible forbids usury and great accumulations of property." You use an example in Tuscany, Italy, and their agrarian art and proper stewardship of the land. Would you please talk about the historically documented effects of usury and the related destruction of nature?
Well, I think that Mr. Berry has hit the nail right on the head there in exactly that wonderful quote that you came up with there. And I would like to add to it from John Muir, you know, who was part of the Sierra movement and who did so much to save the wilderness in California. He came from a Christian upbringing. I think he resented and repudiated some aspects of the rather austere Calvinist upbringing that he had, although they gave him his fantastic work ethic. But he made an analogy with the church when he said, "Protect our legacy for the future, the grandeur of the world that begat us, God's first temples, the wilderness." And I think that we can end this where we started with Dante, because in a properly translated of the Canto 11 in Inferno, and it's just a few lines that talk about usury, although that's not the only section of the Inferno where he goes into usury. But that section, for me, is the most moving because of its emphasis on nature's art as opposed to the kind of manipulation that man brings to it. And that's the fundamental breach there. That's the fundamental breach. And either we are for God's creation or we are not. And there's a lot on the occult side of things that despises creation and that feels that creation is a sorrow and would like to see creation eliminated. And it's not all on the right wing. You know, I mean, with all due respect to my Buddhist friends and many things I've learned from Buddhism, you know, the ultimate of Buddhism is that you're annihilated. You're removed from the scene completely. You get off the wheel of reincarnation. And you have to wonder, in this cleavage between life and death, you have to wonder about things like that. And I'm grateful to my Christian heritage. I'm grateful to people like Wendell Berry and Dante and John Muir, insofar as we all recognize that there is a money power which is undermining this fundamental gift of life that we've been given. And how we approach it, be we right-wing, left-wing, or independent, I think that's where we have to have a conversation. But without the revisionist history that I've tried to provide, I've found that, historically speaking, that conversation has always been misdirected. And we never get to the part where we take a scalpel to the fundamental evil. I mean, in the Christian Bible, in the New Testament, the love of money is the root of all evil. That is a tremendous statement. I mean, someone could call it a tremendous enormity. It's not money per se. Money is very useful. We need it, and we understand that it's important. But the love of money, and we, you know, American society is driven by the love of money. And what is the weaponization of that? It's usury. And it affects everything. I'm a former organic farmer. I tried my hand at that. And, you know, then we tried to do it without loans. And it's a wonderful thing, by the way, of course, to receive loans. There's nothing wrong with that. Even, you know, the Bible says neither a borrower nor lender be, but you put it in the context of the whole Bible. And the Bible recognizes that people in times in their life or their business life will need a loan. And as you say, to be able to be trusted in that way is a magnificent thing for one's self-esteem. I know that among the Mennonites, the Old Order Mennonites and Amish, in many cases, they're able to assist their children and the friends and neighbors by extending interest-free loans. That's in many ways a backbone of their economy. And so these are things that we can do. When I've given speeches at Christian churches and things, probably the most moving aspect of it, I remember one right here in northern Idaho where I reside, and I had two gentlemen, they were brothers, and they said, as a result of your speech, we're going to stop charging money for loans. I guess they were fairly well-to-do farmers from southern Idaho. They had flown up in their private plane for this Christian seminar. And I was deeply moved by that. And that's, you know, that's where it begins. As the Mennonites and Amish are doing it, we can do it as well. You know, because politics and these other things, they're dealing in symptoms. And there's also profound philosophical issues here about parasitism, about how we earn a living and what is the proper way to earn it. And all of these things can be explored further. I just hope that people will refuse to be distracted, because if abolition of interest on money is not a major solution to obstructing the love of money, then what is? I would like to know, because every other approach has been tried. Pound himself was very interested in various nostrums, and he got involved in different things that I regard as sort of quack solutions to things, because, you know, the problem with Pound was he actually admired the Medici. He was tied into the Provençal minstrel tradition, and then he was in love with the Medici for their sponsorship of art. He was very blind to the fact that they were a banking dynasty that was doing incredible harm, that were pioneers in establishing usury. And yet he saw them as running a Monte di Pieta type of operation that was very admirable. So, you know, all of us are capable of being blind at one time or another, and Pound certainly was.
Michael, learning about money lending economics through the lens of divine law and the deep research you've done to show the erosion of church doctrine, removing usury as a sin, adds a very different perspective to predatory banks and exploitive economies. If listeners want to learn more about your work, they could visit revisionisthistory.org. That's all one word, revisionisthistory.org. You considered doing a podcast. Could you please tell listeners about that?
Well, first I'd like to say that both books, The Cult Renaissance Church of Rome and Usury in Christendom, The Mortal Sin That Was and Now Is Not, are both available on Amazon, both in the Kindle and as a published books. And I also very briefly, Jeff, would like to recommend some books by two other authors. Daniel Krenicki's book is in the Kindle. That's History of Money and Usury. And that's very worthwhile, especially for those who are interested in the biblical perspective. And Michael Hudson, who does not share a lot of my views, and I think that it's unfortunate that he has not explored at a deeper level the biblical solution to this, but his most recent book, And Forgive Them Their Debts, by Michael Hudson, is also worth reading. So I don't have a podcast at present because I was scared away by the level of censorship that I've seen. There's this wave of censorship now to interdict books on the left and on the right because they're offending people, you know, and maybe you and I have offended some people in this broadcast today. Sometimes, you know, you have to, the way you learn is to be offended because the lies and delusions that you held on to and considered so precious are being assaulted. You know, so sometimes being offended is a good thing. And we have a blog, if you Google On the Contrary, Michael Hoffman, Revisionist History Newsletter is ours, not to be confused with Malcolm Gladwell's podcast. Jeff Bezos of Amazon started out, there's a speech of his on YouTube 2008 or something like that, where he said, except for pornography and violence, it's going to be wide open. And it was for years and years and years, and contributed to his wealth and the power of Amazon. Now that he's among the wealthiest men in the world and Amazon is on top, there's a great deal of censorship of history books. During Black History Month, they censored Black History books by the Nation of Islam. Three volumes were removed, and it's very unfortunate. It's very unfortunate we're going this way. And the old-time liberals, both of the left and then the true conservatives on the right, would have all been appalled. But I'm not sure how many are left anymore because of the way we hate each other in America, each one on an opposite side of a divide and assuming the worst about the other. And we're not going to get too far if we continue to demonize our fellow Americans.
Michael Hoffman, it's really been a delight to speak with you again, and I hope to have you back on to talk more about your work.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.